From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. In the documentary film Ready to Fly, there's this great photograph of a woman ski jumper in the 1920s. She's totally airborne with skis strapped to her feet, and she's wearing a full-length skirt. By 2009, women's ski jumping had come a long way. Women the world over were competing in the first ski jumping event at the Nordic World Ski Championships. Utah's Lindsey Vann set a world distance record for women and men on the hill that was set for Olympic competition in Vancouver. But the achievements were bittersweet because at the time, women's ski jumping was not an Olympic sport. Today on the program, we're talking about the push for equality by women ski jumpers. Plus, Ballet West's version of the classic ballet, Don Quixote. All that in your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Ski jumping has been an Olympic sport since the modern games were founded in 1924. For men, that is. Women, the International Olympic Committee rationalized, weren't equipped to meet the physical demands of the sport, or there wasn't enough of a record of competition, or there just wasn't enough interest. But a lawsuit, a media firestorm, and a group of dedicated young women from Utah changed that. A new documentary traces the Olympic dreams of ski jumper Lindsey Vann and Women's Ski Jumping USA. And today on the program, we're talking about the hurdles, the lawsuit, the eventual victory for women's ski jumping. Joining me now to talk about this issue is Bill Carrig. He was a professional skier for 10 years before becoming a reporter and a filmmaker. He's the director and producer of the feature film Net Worth and the author of the book-turned-documentary The Edge of Never. And his latest work is the documentary we're talking about today, Ready to Fly. And Bill Carrig joins me in studio. Bill, thanks so much for your time today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Dee Dee Corradini. She served as mayor of Salt Lake City from 1992 to 2000. She's currently a vice president at Prudential Real Estate, but she's here today as president of Women's Ski Jumping USA. And Dee Dee Corradini, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure.
The documentary Ready to Fly premieres tomorrow as part of the 10th anniversary of the 2002 Winter Games in Salt Lake City. It will run for 2 weeks in the 6 Larry H. Miller Megaplex Theaters in Utah, and you can find more information on our website, kcpw.org. Later on in the program, we're talking about the elegance and the Spanish flair of the classic ballet, Don Quixote. But first, women in sport. Have you experienced a glass ceiling on the slopes, the field, or the court? What challenges do you see remaining for women athletes? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Bill Carrig, I want to start with you. Judging from the footage in your documentary, you've been following Lindsey Vann for years. How did you discover this story about Lindsey and the quest for Olympic validation?
Well, I went looking for a story and I'm just a story guy. I went looking for a really good story. And my last film was a story about a father and a son. And this film, I really wanted to do something for my daughter and with my daughter, who was 7 years old at the time. And I went looking for a story with a really strong central character who was a woman, who could be a champion for little girls and for young women coming up. And through a weird set of circumstances, I was reintroduced to Lindsey Vann and Dee Dee Corradini and Women's Ski Jumping USA. I had run a magazine called Wasatch Journal some years ago, and we did a big story on women's ski jumping. And I thought the issue was probably, must have resolved by then. And it hadn't. And I started looking into it, and I met Dee Dee, I met Lindsey, I met the team, and I thought, there's a really good story here. I just hoped that the ending would be what we all hoped for, which was that the IOC would come to its senses and allow women to jump right alongside men. Mm-hmm. So that's why I got into it. I actually only got into it a couple of years ago. I was very fortunate in that Lindsey Vann has lived her whole life in front of the camera. And when you're making a film, you need film of your central character. And there was film. There was lots of photos. So, and there were four other documentarians who had tried to do a documentary on this. Also, NBC, CBS, ABC, Wide World of Sports, all sorts of people had covered this story throughout the years. So we went and culled all the footage that was out there in the world and then followed the team very intimately for a couple years. And from that, we made Ready to Fly.
Before we get into the details of Lindsay's story and the Olympic dream, the journey to the Olympics, give us a bit of history about this particular sport. As I mentioned, you know, ski jumping has been part of the Olympic movement since the very beginning, not so much for women. When did women start to show an interest in ski jumping?
Well, women actually started showing an interest in ski jumping from the very beginning. In 1856, women were ski jumping.
In skirts.
We have that in the film. Yeah. And then in the early 1900s, women who wanted to ski jump actually had to disguise themselves as boys to do it. It's one of those rare sports where women can compete. The best women can compete right alongside with the best men. It's better to be lighter when you're trying to fly. And so women's bodies tend to be lighter, and they fly just as far as the best men. And so I think that that posed a threat throughout the years, especially it was a European-dominated sport until very recently. And I don't think the European men wanted the women jumping right alongside, because in Europe, ski jumping is a rock star sport. The top guys make millions of dollars from endorsements. And if this little 14-year-old girl can fly just as far as this rock star guy, is it really that extreme a sport? Is it that cool? That's been their view. So thankfully, most of those views are changing and have changed.
Didi Corradini, you are well known for your 8 years as Salt Lake City's mayor. You helped launch the city's bid for the 2002 Winter Games here. But how did you get involved with women's ski jumping? I mean, had that been a passion prior to 2002?
No. As a matter of fact, we battled very, very hard for the 2002 Games to get women's skeleton and bobsleigh into the Olympics and succeeded. The IOC wasn't very excited about it, but we made it happen. And at that time, while I was mayor, I thought, good, we now have a gender equal Olympics. Nobody ever mentioned at the time that women still couldn't ski jump. Had I known that, I would have been on that bandwagon back then. And so I didn't find out about it until 2004, when I happened to run into Lindsay Vann at a coffee break and started talking to her, and she was the one that told me that women still couldn't jump in the Olympics. And I was shocked. I was in disbelief at first, because, and so were 99.9% of the people that you mentioned that to. Nobody had could understand it or believe it. Then that turned to anger, and it's been a mission of mine ever since. And I got invited to Women's Ski Jumping USA was a fledgling organization at the time that the parents of the jumpers had put together, and was invited to a $25 a head barbecue to meet the team up in Park City. And I went and met the team, and I became so inspired by their struggles. Here the boys, the male jumpers, were all staying in hotels when they competed around the world. And the girls sometimes would stay in barns in Europe with leaky roofs with the cows and no hot water.
And there's footage of that in the film, which I
thought
was quite remarkable.
and it's just, I became outraged. And the next thing I knew, I was on the board and then president of the board. And it's become a mission of mine for the past 8 years to get these women into the Olympics. And fortunately, with my background with the IOC over the many, many years that I had worked on the Olympics for the 98 bid as well as the 2002 bid, I had some feel for how they think and how they operate. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 8 years.
Well, take us back to that first meeting with Lindsay Vann. What were your initial impressions of this young woman?
Well, it was interesting because I was in a real estate class. And two rows in front of me was this young girl with this beanie hat on, and she kept falling asleep. And she was with this older man. And I kept trying to think, who is this girl, and why is she here if she's falling asleep? So that's why I approached her during the coffee break and started talking, and that's how I found out. And it turned out to be George Vann, her uncle, that was taking the class, and he talked her into taking it with him.
We're speaking with Dee Dee Corradini, former mayor of Salt Lake City, president of Women's Ski Jumping USA, also with documentary filmmaker Bill Carrig. His new film, Ready to Fly, premieres tomorrow as part of the 10th anniversary celebration of the 2002 Winter Olympics here in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Bill Carrig, you mentioned that Lindsay Vann began ski jumping from a very early age. She spent her activity in front of a camera lens, and yet she didn't really like that attention. I want to play a clip from the film and then get you to embellish it. This is Larry Stone, who was the former head of the U.S. ski team, and Lindsay went to live with him for a time to train in Lake Placid. Here's a clip from the film Ready to Fly.
After a jump, and she came running up, and we were talking about her last jump, and all of a sudden we hear this commotion, and we turn and look, and here come like 15 or 20 reporters and media people with cameras and notebooks and just saying, oh, there she is. And they all started running over towards Lindsay. And Lindsay just took a look and just went, oh, my Lord, what is this? And afterwards, we started talking about, Lindsay, if you're going to pursue this, you're going to have to learn how to deal with this. No, I don't want to deal with that. I said, well, we're going to have to start working on that. So over the years, we made a concerted effort to get her a little more comfortable with that kind of attention.
That's Larry Stone from the U.S. ski team from the film Ready to Fly. Bill Carrig, so she's hesitant to have the cameras in her face and to be a spokesperson. So it's kind of ironic that she becomes the leader of this movement to get women's ski jumping as an official event in the Olympics.
Yeah, she's certainly not one of those people who ever sought the spotlight. And that's sort of the central conflict of Lindsay as a character in this film. As a little girl and as a 26-year-old woman, really all she wants to do is fly. She really didn't get into this to get in front of cameras, to be any sort of spokesperson. She just wants to fly, and she's really good at that. But she was called upon, sort of thrust into this place because she could fly so well that she became the world champion. So suddenly she's the go-to person for all the interviews. And all the interviews have to do with gender inequality in sport, with the Olympics, why can't they get in? And she faced a pretty central choice, which was to turn away from all that and let somebody else do it, or to step up, even though she frankly hates being in front of the camera. And so then here I come a couple of years later, saying, hey, I want to follow you around for a couple of years with a camera. And her first answer was no. And we actually, our first meeting was in a coffee shop. And at the Coffee Garden at 9th and 9th. And she had just been up in Vancouver where they lost the court decision. And she was really down. And we met and she just was like, I can't stand to think of having cameras in my face. And I thought, oh, this person, you know, she's made her choice. She's going that direction. And an associate of mine, Whitney Childers, said, no, you guys just got to go skiing. Just go skiing together and talk about it. And we went skiing, and the joy that I saw coming out of this person, the life force was just incredible. Not to mention she's a fantastic skier.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. And so somehow, during one day of skiing, we just decided, you know, we had a lot of fun skiing. I think that she felt like maybe I could be respectful and not stick the camera in her face every second of her life. And we agreed that we'd try and tell this story, and we told it. But that certainly is her central conflict on whether to sort of do something to serve others and for the young women who are coming behind her, or to just fly. And most athletes by nature have to be self-centered. And so that's a tough choice. And there's a portion in the film that I won't go into, but she has to make a choice to do a bone marrow donation, even though it may disrupt or it could even end her athletic career. And I won't tell you what she does, but it's a really interesting choice between serving others and serving yourself.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Bill Carrig. He is a documentary filmmaker, director of the new project called Ready to Fly, which premieres this weekend, tomorrow, as part of the 10th anniversary of the 2002 Winter Games in Salt Lake City. It will run for 2 weeks in the Larry H. Miller Megaplex Theaters along the Wasatch Front. You can find more information on our website, kcpw.org. You mentioned the lawsuit in Vancouver. We're going to talk about that after a quick break. This is City Views on KCBW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Growing up, Lindsey Vann was told she didn't have the right physique, but that didn't keep her from becoming the first women's world ski jumping champion. Still, she wanted to show what she could do in the Olympics, but there was a problem. Ski jumping for women wasn't allowed by the International Olympic Committee. A new documentary follows Vann's journey for equality and acceptance. It's called Ready to Fly. It premieres tomorrow as part of the 10th anniversary of the 2002 Winter Games here in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details on that a bit later. But if you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-8255 is our number. 801-355-TALK. With us in studio, Bill Carrig, the director, the documentary filmmaker behind Ready to Fly. Also with us, Didi Corradini, former Salt Lake City mayor and president of Women's Ski Jumping USA. Before the break, Bill, you mentioned a lawsuit that women had decided to sue the Vancouver Olympic Committee. And Didi Corradini, you were part of that initial legal action. Why? Why sue?
Well, we tried everything. Our goal was to get the women into Vancouver 2010. And when I first got involved 8 years ago, first we had to get the women into the World Championships, so we had to work with the FIS, the International Ski Federation. And that took us a couple of years. And then we were told after we got the women into the World Championships that the FIS would recommend to the IOC that the women be included in the World Championships in 2009 and would be included in Vancouver 2010 Olympic Games. And when we were at this FIS meeting, four of us flew over and lobbied like crazy. It was an uphill battle to get that done. But they assured us, once we ask the IOC, they're going to put it in. You're in for 2010. So we did everything nicely, the way it's supposed to be done,
the
by
way
the
you
rules.
Did it for women's skeleton. And
exactly. And worked with the IOC. I still know probably half to two-thirds of the IOC members. They tend to be long-termers. And we thought everything was on track. And then all of a sudden, two of us flew over for the program commission meeting of the IOC, and the program commission recommends to the IOC executive board what new sports or events they're going to include in Vancouver 2010. And I had sent one, we did a beautiful brochure, sent all kinds of information to the members of the committee that I knew. I called every one of them, and they told me on the phone, you know, no problem. This is a no-brainer. Of course we're going to let the women in. We'll vote for you. So Peter Jerome and I flew over, sat in the lobby of this hotel. I learned what a lobbyist is, by the way, in this whole process. You sit in the lobby, and you wait for people to come by, and then you grab them, which we did, and I greeted everybody that I knew. Everything was upbeat the night before the meeting. And then the next day was the meeting, and Peter and I sat in the lobby when the meeting was supposed to be over and folks would come back, and nobody would speak to us or look at us. And I knew we were in trouble. Turns out that they'd voted us down. And 3 months later, the IOC executive board took their recommendation and voted us down. So that's when we decided we've got to do something because time is running out. We were now, I think, a year and a half out from Vancouver 2010. And a friend of mine is a lawyer who's part of an international barristers organization. And so I said to Marty, Marty, you know, we need help in Vancouver. Do you know any lawyers in Vancouver? And she said, yeah, I just happen to know a guy named Ross Clark. Great guy, very senior, major law firm. And so we flew up, met with Ross. He couldn't think of what to do. But he called me a couple of weeks later and he said, I've got an idea. I think we can sue. We can't sue the IOC because nobody controls them. But we could sue the Vancouver Organizing Committee, saying three things. Number one, the IOC is discriminating against these women based on the facts. Number two, VANOC is subject to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms in Canada, which is their non-discrimination Title IX. And three, therefore, VANOC cannot host a men's only event. So we decided to run with it. And we were doing all kinds of other stuff, but that's how the lawsuit started.
I want to play a clip from the film just to set this up. Maybe you can help me, Bill. This is a clip from Dick Pound, who is... tell us who Dick Pound is.
Well, Dick Pound at the is a former IOC executive board member. He's world famous. He's sort of notorious. Within our film, he is the voice of the IOC. And so the IOC wouldn't grant us, the executive board wouldn't grant us any interviews, but Dick Pound would.
And there's a second voice, Mario, I'm blanking on his name.
Gianfranco Casper?
Gianfranco Casper,
who was the president of the FIS. It gets all very complicated, but the president of the FIS also sits on the IOC executive board. This is one thing that drew me to this story. It's very much an old boys club. It's very much a country club. And if you're in, it doesn't matter what you do. But if you're outside those doors, it's tough to get in.
This is a clip from the documentary Ready to Fly. This is Dick Pound speaking first.
Well, I mean, they must be getting free legal advice. If I'd been advising as a lawyer, I'd have said, don't take this action in the first place. It's the wrong thing to do, and it's not going to succeed.
Don't make too much noise now. Let's work to be in the next Olympics, which will be in 2014.
Carrying on with it is, I think, it does more harm than good.
More harm than good. Dee Dee Cordini, in hindsight, do you think the lawsuit was still a good idea?
Absolutely. I think it was a tipping point for us. We had already made a lot of waves with the IOC. We had caught the international media's attention. We were getting all kinds of press internationally, including editorials, let the women in. But this was the tipping point, I think. And we went ahead and filed the lawsuit. And the tough part, and I have to admire Lindsay for this, is we knew that we couldn't do it as Women's Ski Jumping USA. We had to find 15 athletes from around the world, not just US and Canada, but we needed Europeans. And it's very tough for the European women to engage in something like this, let alone our own. And Lindsay Vann struggled about being the first athlete to say she would sign on to a lawsuit. She was afraid of getting thrown off her team.
Well, I think the fears were valid, considering what we just heard from Dick Pound. The court ruled against you, as we know now, and this was really a sucker punch for Lindsay. I mean, she just took it hard. Bill, how did she respond as an athlete, as a person?
Well, first of all, she stepped up when no one else would, and she felt really mortified. Because she went out in front of sort of the world press and she broke down. She cried, which she was sort of ashamed of later. And she was just absolutely physically exhausted and emotionally spent. And the world champion quit ski jumping.
So I find that remarkable.
It's really remarkable when you think that here is from the time she was a little girl. All she wanted to do was ski jump, and the rules and the regulations and the ridiculous bureaucracy had so sapped her incredible spirit that she just couldn't keep going anymore. So she just walked away from ski jumping as the reigning world champion. She just quit.
What brought her back? She took a year off.
Yeah. Well, and we were filming her during this time. And so she went skiing. That's what she did. She walked away from ski jumping, and she did a lot of backcountry touring. She skied in the resorts at Snowbird and at Alta. But she did a lot of time in the backcountry just thinking and getting quiet. And she just realized that there's so much joy to be found for her. And it's an incredible experience. If you can, I've gotten a chance to fly off some of the smaller jumps. And to fly off that 120 is just, they're flying. And the joy that she found in doing that, she just had to come back to, no matter what it cost. That was her decision.
Even during Lindsay's absence, Didi Cordini, the battle to get this sport in the Olympics continued on. In the film, in April 2011, you gathered the team around, I believe it's at your house in Park City, for a conference call. Describe what that moment was like for you as someone sitting in the room waiting to hear from the IOC.
We were all scared because we'd been told no so many times. We'd had our hopes up and then dashed. And so the athletes decided they wanted to be in a quiet place because in case their hopes were dashed again. So nobody was really expecting it. I was cautiously optimistic that it would finally happen. And when the announcement was made, we were listening live, there was a moment of joy, but then silence. And it was a almost relief, and I started crying. Hmm. It was just 8 years of being told no and being put down. And I feel teary just thinking about it. It was quite an emotional time.
Mm-hmm. What did it mean for those athletes that you were surrounded by at that moment?
Everything. And I think it has shown all the athletes that you just never give up. We knew we were doing the right thing, not only for these athletes, but for future generations of women. There is still so much discrimination against women in sport. And we knew this was an important, I think the athletes finally got it, that tough as this is important for the future of women.
Why are the Olympics so important? Why is gaining access to that particular event? What does that mean?
It's the top. And if you're good, you want to at least have the opportunity to go to the top. And it also has a financial implications. If you're not, we have struggled to raise money for these women. It's an everyday struggle. We're still struggling to put together a world-class team, and we are the top team in the world right now. But we struggle to get money so these women can compete around the world. And sometimes we have to cut them out of certain competitions because we don't have the money to send them. And so if you're in the Olympics, the money flows much more easily.
What was the tipping point, do you think, for the IOC? Why did they finally give the nod years after your initial appeals?
Because I think we had embarrassed them so badly. And the Canadian courts, what we did win on is the Canadian courts said, the IOC, you are discriminating against these women based on the facts. And that they have never been told that by a court before. And so that was a huge win for us. And I think they knew that they had better let the women in for 2014 because the media was totally on our side and they were going to look even worse.
Hmm. Bill Carrig, you mentioned earlier in the program about Lindsay Vann becoming a bone marrow donor. As someone who relies on top physical conditioning and, you know, is in really what can be a very brutal, demanding sport, what was that decision-making process like for her? Why did she decide to do that?
Well, and when you say ski jumping is a demanding sport, let me just put that in context. Lindsay, since she was a little girl, has logged every single jump she's ever made. Every single jump. She's had more than 20,000 jumps. That's 20,000 landings. She's broken her back. She's busted her spleen. She's had numerous other smaller injuries. And keeping an athlete's body, you know, going is the main challenge, right? And performing on a high level. And so through an odd set of circumstances, Lindsay learns that she's a match, and not just a match, but a match for a total stranger who's a 49-year-old white male. Now, middle-aged white guys have not really been very helpful for Lindsay in her career because that's what the IOC is. It's all middle to later aged white guys. But so her choice is, okay, I'm going to put my career and my passion and everything I've lived for on the line to save someone's life who I don't even know, who represents an archetype that I'm kind of angry with. And so it's a really interesting setup, a really interesting decision. And what really goes to her character is she never even paused, not even for a second. You know, she said, boom, I'm going to do it. And you know, I'm going to risk missing the world championships. She's the reigning world champion. And I'm going to try and save someone's life, which really, if you just, we use those words fairly glibly, but to save someone's life is a pretty amazing thing. And she never even paused to consider, oh, wow, this may ruin me as an athlete. She just did it.
You describe vividly her passion for the sport, for life, for human life. What's next for Lindsay Vann? I understand she's at a competition right now. That's why she's not in studio with us.
Yeah, I just texted with her. She currently is third in the world. Sarah Hendrickson, who is from Park City, she's also in the film. And she's 16 now, or is she 17?
17.
17 now.
She looks very young.
That's
all I know.
She's a young 17. She is currently ranked number one in the world and probably will win the world championships. But Lindsay, at age 27, is currently sitting third in the world. And lots of people have said, well, you know, surely you can't hang on till 2014 when they will get a chance to compete in the games, because women have never ski jumped at 29. But as it turns out, the average age for male ski jumpers is 29. It's just that the women have never had any way to keep going. They've not been in the Olympics. They've not been financially supported. The competition hasn't extended that late, so they've moved on with their lives and their careers. So for Lindsay, she's going to try and jump in 2014. And I would not bet against her.
Let's talk about 2014. The Winter Games will be held in Sochi. Didi Cordini, are you going?
Absolutely. And I think there's going to be a fairly large contingent of folks from Park City that have been involved in this story for all these years that want to go as well. So we need to be there. It will be the story of the 2014 Games. And we want to be there to cheer these women on, all of them.
What's it going to mean to you personally to be there?
Just a dream come true. Finally, to see these girls in the Olympics. And I think the most emotional thing for me will be to see them walking into that stadium as Olympians with the United States team. That is going to be heartwarming in addition to watching them jump.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look forward to 2014 then. Didi Cordini, former mayor of Salt Lake City, current president of Women's Ski Jumping USA. Didi Cordini, thanks very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
And Bill Carrig, filmmaker, documentarian, director of the new film, Ready to Fly, which premieres tomorrow night as part of the 2002 10th anniversary celebration. We'll have links on our website, kcpw.org. Bill Carrig, thanks to you for your time, and good luck with the film.
Thanks very much.
Up next, we're talking about Don Quixote, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. The tale of a man who tilts at windmills and searches for Dulcinea, his ideal love, has endeared readers for centuries. And the antics of Cervantes' unlikely hero translate beautifully to the stage. Ballet West brings the legendary Don Quixote ballet to life once again. Joining me now to talk about the narrative, the music, the choreography of this classic production is Adam Skloot. He is the artistic director for Ballet West. Ballet West. He's been with the company since 2007. Prior to that, he was the Associate Artistic Director of the Joffrey Ballet and Adam Skloot. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
If you've seen Don Quixote the Ballet or have questions about the upcoming production, feel free to join us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Adam Skloot, I think we're all familiar with elements of this classic storyline of Don Quixote of La Mancha, the man from La Mancha. The ballet deals with just a few chapters of the Cervantes classic. Maybe briefly describe the narrative of the ballet for us.
Yeah, sure. So about two of these chapters of the Cervantes novel are depicted when he goes to the city of Barcelona and meets the beautiful Khitri, who he envisions to be his Dulcinea. And during that time, we're also introduced to Khitri's lover, the handsome and penniless barber, Basilio. And so we're involved in their story. Khitri wants to marry Basilio. Basilio has no money. Khitri's father wants to marry her off to a wealthy fop, Gamache. She does not love Gamache, obviously. And so the Don Quixote, stands up for her honor and protects her and helps her to marry Basilio. It's a simple story. It's lovely. It's fun. And it's the stuff of great classical ballets.
Sure. Don Quixote, an older ballet, even older than Swan Lake, than Sleeping Beauty, first performed in 1871. What accounts for its staying power, do you think?
You know, I think it's charm. It's joy, it's technical brilliance. I mean, here, when an audience comes to see Don Quixote, they're going to see a funny, lively story. Kids will be rolling in the aisles because, I mean, there's some really broad slapstick in it, but also great technical dancing. So you're also going to see the athleticism that keeps it exciting for everyone who loves ballet and everyone who doesn't understand it. This is why I think that since its inception, and yes, the version that you're talking about was 1871, but it's much, much older than that. In fact, the 1700s is when the first versions of Don Quixote come out, and then the first version of it, 1869, and then the version that we're looking at from 1871. It's exciting. It's funny. It's a nonstop thrill ride. That's what I call this ballet, joyous and fun.
Music for the ballet was this production of the ballet was composed by the Austrian composer Ludwig Mincus, who was commissioned to do so for the Bolshoi Theater in Moscow. Well known for composing music specifically for ballet. I guess I'm wondering, how important is that to a dancer, to have music that was had you in mind, you know, that was composed just for you?
Yeah, that's a very big deal, to have music that is composed exactly for you as a dancer. And this is what Ludwig Mincus's great gift was, and what we still see as it. He creates music that's incredibly danceable. It's what we call musique dansant in the French term, because so many of our ballet terms are in French. And dancers can feel the rhythm, feel the beat, feel what it is that we're trying to produce, and it drives it. It's also very much based on the individual dancer in a different way than another composer might be. The contemporary composers that we now choreograph to, they set their score and we dance to that.
Mm-hmm.
At that period of time in the 19th century, the late 1800s, the composer created the score based on what the dancer needed to do. But a good one, like Ludwig Mincus, created music that was also beautiful to the audience's ear, as well as being suitable to be able to dance all of the technical steps and athleticism that is required in ballet.
Well, let's take a listen to part of the score for the ballet Don Quixote. This is from the entrance of the main character, Don Quixote. Let's take a listen, and then we'll get your thoughts. Adam Skloot.
Thank you.
In the Ballet West production of Don Quixote, how does Don Quixote enter? How do we meet him?
Okay, well, we actually meet Don Quixote before we meet anyone else in the ballet. The music that you just heard is Don Quixote's theme. And this is his theme as he is off to one quest or another. And even though we go through many different scenarios and stories throughout the ballet, Don Quixote's theme keeps on coming back. We meet Don Quixote at the very beginning. He is dreaming of his novels about the great knights errant. He wants to be a great knight and be the champion of the world and rescue damsels in distress. And we see him, he wakes up. He wakes up with a start and says, I have to go off and rescue this next damsel in distress. And so he enlists his friend, Sancho Panza, and off they go. And that's how we meet him. And then very soon we are introduced to the other characters in the ballet.
We're speaking with Adam Skloot. He is the artistic director of Ballet West. Ballet West, of course, will be premiering Don Quixote. I believe it starts tomorrow.
Yeah,
tomorrow. February 10th. We'll have ticket information and more on our website, kcpw.org. If you'd like to join us with your observations about Don Quixote, what you'd like to see in the ballet production, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. This particular version is choreographed by Anna Marie Holmes. Tell us about this premier ballerina.
Okay, so I am thrilled that we're doing a production by Anna Marie Holmes. Anna Marie Holmes is the first American woman to have studied, trained, and danced in Soviet Russia during the Cold War. This is and she brought back, when she left Soviet Russia and came back to the West, she brought back all of these great classics. And her version of Don Quixote is based on this original version that we talked about. That's a very special gift that we have in the West, because she brings knowledge that hardly anyone in the world, certainly in the Western world, holds today. She has an illustrious reputation, shall I say. She's had an illustrious career. She stages these works around the world. You know, she was just in Buenos Aires. Before that, she was in Oslo. And now she comes to Salt Lake City and is bringing us her Don Quixote.
How'd you get so lucky?
You know, I got to know Anna Marie a few years ago, and I was very, I admired her tremendously and told her how much I admired her history and her reputation. And I said, you know, I would love you to stage one of your great Russian classics for Ballet West, because they're so much fun. They're such great audience pleasers that I want one of those for our company. And she said, sure. And I had originally selected a different ballet, and she said, oh, no. Every great ballet company in the world has a Swan Lake, a Sleeping Beauty, a Giselle, a Nutcracker, and a Don Quixote. And I thought to myself, well, we've got the other ones, Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, Giselle, Nutcracker. We need a good Don Quixote.
So has Ballet West never done a Don Quixote before?
You know, in the early 1980s, under director Bruce Marks, we did a version of Don Quixote. But as Anna Marie said to me very clearly, it's not my version of Don Quixote. Mm. And my version of Don Quixote is based on the great original. You're going to want this one. And I have to agree with her. After her putting it together, it's brilliant. I laugh every night I see it. It's uproariously funny. I'm excited by the dancing. Her work is genius, and she's really, really brought Ballet West a great gift.
It's based on the original by the most influential ballet master of all time. I don't know how to say his name, Marius Petipa?
Petipa.
So how has Holmes taken that original material and kind of shaped it for this performance?
Yeah, so Marius Petipa, the choreographer of Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty and the Nutcracker, all of his work is right there. And in fact, the great dance steps that he created are basically all the same. But what she's done, what Anna Marie has done, is taken it and made the story move a little bit faster, so that in a 21st century way, we as a current audience can appreciate and enjoy it. At times, it's like watching a sitcom. the action and the comedy go by so quickly. And then you'll see some great dancing, which is so exciting and dynamic. And this is what she's put together and done. So she hasn't really changed any of Petipa's great choreographies. She's just adapted the way that the whole story is put together in a way that we as 21st century audiences can enjoy.
Who are the principal performers in your production?
Well, this is a remarkable thing. Ms. Holmes, Anna Marie, was so taken by Ballet West that she decided she wanted to put on four different casts of leading dancers. I was not convinced, and we actually had an argument about that for a little while because I felt, you know, this was a little too much, but she insisted, and I have to tell you, on the eve of our opening night, she's absolutely right. We have Christopher Rood, our wonderful established principal as Basilio. We have Bekan Sisk, a beautiful young newcomer to the company, as Kitri in one cast. In another cast, we have my beautiful established soloist, Elizabeth McGrath, as Kitri, and in and her partner, demi-soloist Rex Tilton. In another cast, soloist Tom Mattingly and demi-soloist Sayaka Otaki. And in another cast, our newly named principal dancer, Catherine Lawrence, with new soloist Ronnie Underwood. And through it all, our brilliant principal ballerina, Christiana Bennett, as the Queen of the Dryads, who is a very important figure who sort of helps those two lead dancers. So every night that an audience comes, they're going to see a spectacular cast. So I'm going to tell you, there is not one less than night in this run of the show.
Why did she think it was so important to have that kind of rotation?
Well,
Anna Marie Holmes.
Yeah, what Ms. Holmes told me was, you have so many fine dancers. I want them all to be seen.
How flattering.
Isn't that wonderful? That's a wonderful tribute to us as at Ballet West here in Salt Lake City. I mean, that's really speaks to the caliber of artists that we have here.
We're speaking with Adam Skloot, Artistic Director of Ballet West. Ballet West Don Quixote starts tomorrow. It runs at various times throughout the month of February at the Capitol Theater in Salt Lake City. Ticket information is on our website, kcpw.org, or you can find out more by calling Ballet West directly at 801-869-6900. Adam Skloot, at its heart, ballet is a very theatrical art. Talk about the costumes, the sets associated with Don Quixote.
Well, I'm going to say that this production of Don Quixote is perhaps the grandest production that Ballet West has done in many, many years. And this whole year has been about grand productions, from our fall production of Dracula into Don Quixote. It is enormous in for our technical reasons. That, you know, we say, oh my gosh, how are we going to fit it all on the stage? But when you see it, it's so vibrant, so beautiful. I mean, think of the ports of Barcelona with an oceanscape in the background and wonderful bridges and doorways, and then the costumes, a fantastic Spanish flair with the matadors and their capes flying, and the beautiful señoritas with their fans. This is a spectacular production. It's what we call grand ballet, grand scale ballet at its best.
I'm going to play just a little bit of that Spanish flair from the ballet Don Quixote. You can pretty much imagine a bullfight to that, right?
Oh, yeah. And in fact,
there
are.
You have bullfights in this production. What's the best thing about this particular show that has just endeared you? What is it, working with Anna Marie Holmes? Is it the music that is just so beautiful and lyrical? Is it the kind of slapstick humor that you find in it?
Well, I think you've just hit the nail on all of it. It's everything. I mean, here you've just talking about this, you know, beautiful music, this slapstick humor, this incredible, challenging dancing. I mean, the dancers have eaten this up. What I've loved so much is watching Ballet West's company dancers just devour every step and every piece of information that Anna Marie Holmes has given them. I mean, we're dealing with history here, but it's not history that's old and stuffy. It's history that's current and now and fun. And I've loved it. And watching all of them just dance to the top of their level, competing to be better and better, and each one showing what they can do. This is an exciting production. It never flags. Energy-wise, you're never going to sit there twiddling your thumbs. You're going to either be laughing or marveling at the technical skill of the dancers. And I think this is one of the things that has kept Don Quixote a classic and a leading ballet in the world for so many years.
Adam Skloot, he is Artistic Director of Ballet West. Ballet West Don Quixote starts tomorrow at the Capitol Theater in Salt Lake City, various dates throughout the month. More information on our website, kcpw.org. And Adam Skloot, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Tamara Kemsley and Katie Sheen Abbott and Jesse Ellis. Next time, it's Politics Up Close. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.